is before us today. And I'm going to ask council to please remember to sign in if you have not already done so, so that the clerk can take the sign in. You can do it either before or after you argue. And we will begin with the Stillwell case. Do you have consultation? And before we begin, I just have another general announcement that I would make. We have some cases that involve criminal cases that involve juveniles, and I would alert counsel that if you're not already aware of this, the oral arguments are taped and are available online for people to listen to, so I would ask you not to identify juveniles or victims by name, just for confidentiality purposes. So, having said all those administrative announcements, Mr. Bennett, would you like to reserve some time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, I would like to reserve 3 minutes.
3 minutes, certainly. This is the case of Dorothy Silva versus the Commonwealth of Virginia, and whenever you'd like to say, we'll be happy to hear.
May it please the court, my name is Shalev Ben-Abraham and I represent Ms. Silva from the Fairfax County Public Defender's Office. Would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, Your Honor. Your Honors, there's two assignments of error here. The first one is whether or not the trial court had the ability to revoke any jail time and put Ms. Silva in jail for a probation violation when the initial order, final sentencing order in that case, only suspended the period for which she was given jail for 3 years. From that date, the alleged probation violation having occurred after that 3 year period, and the hearing occurred after that 3 year period. What initially happened was Ms. Silva was sentenced to 2 years with 1 year and 1 month suspended for a period of 3 years.
Given the companion case, I'm guessing you know that we're interested in whether in the case of whether she actually has an interest. Is there any collateral consequence that she currently faces or potentially faces as a result of the prior probation?
There is, Your Honor. The main collateral consequence here is that she is, as having been found guilty, she also owes court costs. And those court costs, if she had not been found guilty of the probation violation, would not be there. That is a collateral consequence that she still owes as a result of this. And further, Virginia law is if you don't pay your court costs or you miss a payment, your license will be suspended, which of course then can also lead to other criminal charges, but that is also a collateral consequence. When looking at this, the other panel in making its decision in finding this to be moot without giving myself or the government the opportunity to address whether or not it was moot, because it was set for merits and then we never got to the merit argument, specifically references the fact that Ms. Silva, the Commonwealth, can recover from Ms. Silva all the costs from the trial court, but then also saying, but there's no collateral consequences. And it is clear, I think, to me that when you impose court costs as a result of a conviction on someone, this court can grant a remedy. I think the mootness doctrine in Virginia is slightly different than just necessarily case or controversy, which is the language that's used a lot of the time, but it's whether or not an appellate court or a court can grant a remedy to the person bringing forth their claim. And this court can grant a remedy. If this court reverses the decision of the trial court and finds that the trial court couldn't impose this, this court would erase those court costs, and that is a remedy that can be granted. I think mootness only applies when there's no remedy that can be granted. And the cases the other panel actually cites to deals a lot with habeas and also deals a lot with federal case law, where there's a whole Article 3 case or controversy issue about whether federal courts can hear cases. And we don't. I don't believe we have that. In fact, I actually believe that cases can be certified to the Virginia Supreme Court from other states for advisory opinions. I'm not suggesting that this is one of those cases, because I do believe that there's controversy. There are concrete and discrete and collateral consequences as a result of her probation violation. So I do think that it is not moot, and I think, and I say this with all deference and respect to the other panel, but I think the panel should have given myself and the AG an opportunity to address that before making its decision, because I think even within that decision, the panel recognizes there are court costs that she owes as a result of the conviction, and those court costs are concrete and our collateral and what makes this case still viable and what is a remedy that this court can grant if it reverses and dismisses, those court costs will be erased. Not to mention the court costs of having to file the briefing and having to go through this whole process. Also, there are court costs on her as a result of that, too. So, Your Honor, I don't know if the court has more questions about that, but I do believe that this is actually still a viable case where there's a remedy that can be granted. Getting to assignment one, however, is when the court initially sentenced her in January of 2010, the court put her on a period of probation for 2 years, but also suspended the remaining jail sentence for a period of 3 years. So there was already a variance, and that's recognized in the law as part of the remedial natures of probation, that courts will, that these are distinct and separate concepts, probation, the period for which suspension is suspended for. When Ms. Silva was found in violation in January of 2012, the court revoked 90 days and then put her on 2 years more of active probation. And this is where I think the reading of Jacobs that I have is maybe a little bit different than the Assistant General's reading, which is that Jacobs says you can't negate or erase the first final order. Now, 19.2306 directs that if you find someone in violation of probation, you shall revoke the remaining sentence. And in Jacobs, what happened is the trial court found the person in violation, gave some time back, but not all the time. And the question was, did that mean because he didn't specifically say we're resuspending the remaining portion of jail, did that result in that being erased? And the answer is no, because the code actually directs that it shall be revoked. So it's implicit that if he only gives 90 days back, the remaining sentence is suspended of the imposition of sentence. That is different, though, and distinct from the time period for which that sentence remains suspended. And what we have here is a scenario where, if you understand the way I understand Jacobs, is Jacobs says that's right, the 90 days that Ms. Silva was given meant 10 months were left over her head. But that didn't erase the January 10th, 2010 order, which held that that remaining 10 months is suspended only until January 14th, 2013. And even though the court gave a two-year active probation at that point, that second year of probation essentially was ineffective, which is what Hartless, with this court decided, which is a 29 VA App 172, that probation that's not concurrent with a suspended period of time is ineffective. And so what essentially happened is when the court announced that ruling, it really was saying, we're putting you on active probation for 1 year. Now, that's not to say the court necessarily, but the bigger tension and problem we have is we don't know and we can't read from the court what exactly it meant to do. The Commonwealth, you know, asserts the idea that because the court gave 2 years of active probation, it meant to suspend the remaining portion of the jail sentence for 2 years. But there's nothing to indicate that that's true. And in fact, in this case, we know that the trial court had already originally created a variance between probation and the period for which the sentence was suspended. So to assume that the next time around she meant to have them coordinated, the trial court to have them coordinated, is an assumption that I don't believe this trial court or this court of appeals can make, and it's not an assumption that we can make because we have to look at what the orders actually say. And by looking at what the orders actually say, what was left after January of 2012 was 1 more year of suspended jail, the period suspended for, and that the court, by putting her on 2 years of active probation, that second year just became ineffective. And that's when the alleged violations occurred, was during the second year of the probation. But her jail sentence had lapsed at that point, the suspended period. The Commonwealth points to Briggs, and I address this in my reply brief. Briggs was a case that's factually dissimilar to ours. Briggs first started with the trial court suspending the imposition of sentence, saying, I'm not imposing a sentence, be of good behavior. And then subsequently, within a year or so, Briggs violated good behavior, and then the court imposed a sentence, which was 10 years with 5 years suspended. Then he violated probation after he got out after the 5 years, and his counsel tried to argue that the 10 years had lapsed by the time that violation came around because he went to the first date, the imposition of sentence date. But this court said, no, you have to look at when the sentence was imposed. Because the imposition, the suspended imposition of sentence is not when the sentence was imposed, it was imposed a year later, so you're within the time frame, that 10-year time frame. We don't have that here. That's not what happened here. And the reason for that is that Code Section 19.2.303.1 gives the trial court the option to either impose, when it's doing a suspended imposition of sentence or suspending a jail period, to fix a time period for which that is to apply or not. If the trial court does not fix a time period for which that applies, then 19.2.306 would control, which essentially reverts that you can violate anyone for the maximum statutory period that they were suspended, that they could have initially gotten. But if they do fix a time period, that's what controls. Briggs, there was no fixed time period. However, in our case, there was a fixed time period, 3 years. The court invoked the provisions of 303.1. And so therefore, we don't have the same situation as Briggs. Furthermore, the Commonwealth also relies on the Wright case, which was decided before 19.2.306B came into play. So the Wright was decided in 2000 and relies on the Briggs case primarily, which was factually different. But more importantly, what Wright does is Wright said at the time that at the time probation violations had to have been heard within the time period that the person was still on probation. So in Wright, the argument was he was no longer on probation when he was sentenced for the probation violation. And therefore, this court found, well, that's not quite accurate due to some issues. However, the legislature, the General Assembly, fixed that problem and 2 years later in 19.2.306B and said that...
Just going back to getting deep in your argument, I'm sitting and mulling this over. I did have one question that I wanted to ask you about the... about whether this is moot, and really more so, what is the effect of our previous order? Is there this is the same case, this is the same party, this is the same issue. Is there a collateral estoppel or law of the case preclusion that prevents us from deciding it differently than the prior panel decided?
The quick answer to that is no, Your Honor. And the reason why is that the other decision is an unpublished decision, so I don't think it even has precedential value to this panel.
There's no precedential value, but is there a collateral estoppel issue or law of the case issue? The panel in a final order has decided that there were no collateral consequences. That's a factual determination. And why isn't that factual determination binding in this same case?
Well, I think when Your Honor is saying law of the case, we have to, even though it's the same parties, they are two different cases and two distinct cases. It's not the same trial court that was acting below. So Ms. Sill was on probation in the first case with one judge. She subsequently picked up a new charge and was on probation with a different judge. So they are technically the same parties, but they are in fact different cases. And I see that I only have 3 minutes left. I don't know if
you can answer my question.
Yes, Your Honor.
May it please the Court. Christian Hamill for the Commonwealth. Good morning. I'll address the mootness issue first, since it's a threshold issue and clearly an issue the panel would like to discuss. As your honors know, I filed a notice of the court's decision to dismiss the corresponding appeal as moot, but I did not myself move this court to dismiss this case as moot. And after much thought, consideration, and research into Virginia case law, I came to the conclusion not to ask this court to dismiss this case as moot, and I'll tell the court why. I do think, while there is no Virginia case law directly and exactly on all fours as this case, I do think that in my own examination of the case law, that opposing counsel is probably correct that under Virginia case law, having to pay court costs is enough of a collateral consequence that it makes the case not moot. And I'll cite the court a couple of cases, which I don't think have been cited to the court yet. They're both Supreme Court of Virginia cases. One is from 2011, and that case is the Christian case. And the site is 282 VA 392. And the second case is Cartwright, C-A-R-T-W-R-I-G-H-T. That's 270 VA 58. That's in 2005. Those are both Virginia FOIA cases. And the facts in those cases essentially is the petitioner filed to get some documents from an organization. The organization, under Virginia's version of FOIA, the organization denied him and said, you're not entitled to those documents. He then appealed. While the appeal was pending, the organization said, never mind, we'll give you the documents, and then moved to dismiss the appeals as moot. And what the petitioner in each case argued was that because under the statute, if he was entitled to those documents, he was entitled to court costs and he was entitled to attorney's fees, that made those cases not moot. And in both of those cases, the Supreme Court of Virginia held that that was correct, that because he could still get relief from court costs and attorney's fees, the cases were not moot. And while that was a FOIA case, and this was a probation revocation case, so arguably there may be some grounds for distinguishing the two, I was not able to come up with any that I felt strong enough about to argue in a motion to dismiss. So that is why I proceeded as I have. Unless there are any additional questions on the mootness issue, I'm happy to move to the merits of the case. On the merits of the case, sorry, I have a question. On the merits of the case, there are really, this case can be resolved basically by answering two questions, and they're fairly straightforward. The first question is whether the trial court implicitly extended Ms. Sealwood's term of suspension, the term of her suspended sentence, when the trial court very explicitly extended her probation period for 2 years. And courts have held repeatedly that is permissible to draw that conclusion. The second question is whether or not Ms. Celia's 2-year extension of her probation and implicitly her suspended sentence ended either 2 years after that extension was announced in the revocation hearing, or whether it ended 2 years after the eventual corresponding revocation order was entered into the record. I'll take that question first because I think that's the easiest question. The trial court told us exactly what her order meant. Judge Rausch entered the revocation order that extended Ms. Steele's probation for 2 years, and that order extending her probation from 2 years, there's actually two, since there were two underlying sentences here. One's at page 22 of the appendix, and one is at page 24 of the appendix, and both orders state that the court further ordered that the defendant's probation be extended for 2 years from today's date. And so when opposing counsel filed the motion to dismiss and they came into court for a revocation hearing after the fact, there was some discussion about what does today's date mean? Does it mean the date it was announced after the revocation hearing or the date that the order was entered? And on page 73 and 75 of the appendix, the trial judge, Judge Rausch, very clearly states that her interpretation of her own order is that today's date means from the date the order was entered, not from the date it was announced. So that gets you a 2-year extension from February the 12th of 20, let me make sure I give it to you correctly, February 13th of 2012 gets you 2 years to February 13th of 2014, and then the only question is whether Ms. Celia got notice before 1 year after that expiration. So whether she got notice before February 13, 2015. Yes, Your Honor.
I know we have a case, and the name escapes me right at the moment, where a defendant was convicted of violating the terms of the suspended sentence for actions that occurred between the time the sentence was imposed by the court and the time the order was actually entered.
Okay.
So if you accept that proposition, why is this term effective as of the date of the order as opposed to the date it was imposed?
And I think it's probably important for me to clarify what I'm arguing. I'm not arguing that her probation did not begin until the order was entered. What I'm arguing is that it ended 2 years after the order was entered. But for those 17 days in between the announcement and the entry of the order, her probation would still have been in effect. That's the way the trial court read the order. I think this court has to give deference to that.
Your argument is that was what the trial court intended to do, in fact stated that she had in fact done. The question then becomes, did she have the power to do what she claimed she wanted to do?
So there is then the question that arises as to her authority, whether or not that is just a matter of determining how, if she did successfully extend it, how long did that extension last? It lasts until February 13th, 2014, and thus she had to get notice by February 13th, 2015, and she was served that final bench warrant that had all the charges in it on February 5th, 2015. then clearly we were within that one-year window, as long as you accept the date of entry as the date where the 2 years begins, and I'm also arguing the 17 days in between also count. The next question, which was the initial question for the court, is whether or not by implicitly extending, or by explicitly extending Ms. Celia's probation for 2 years, she also implicitly extended the term of her suspended sentence. And this court's, based on this court's case law, in Hartless, in Littow, in Wright, in Briggs, I think repeatedly this court has reasoned that because probation is in a period of probation is ineffective unless there's a suspended sentence hanging over that probationer's head. What opposing counsel has argued is that that means that even though she tried to extend it for 2 years, because she forgot to also say explicitly, I'm also extending your suspended sentence for another 2 years, she wasn't able to do what she tried to do because she didn't say the magic words. And really, you had to go back to the initial imposition of that suspended sentence. And so 1 year into that 2 year period of her attempted extension of the probation, his probation effectively ended because his suspended sentence ended because she forgot to explicitly state, I'm also extending that. What Virginia courts have held repeatedly is that because a probation period is basically premised on the fact that there's a suspended sentence hanging over that probationer's head, so if that probationer violates the terms of their probation, unless there's some suspended sentence out there that the trial court can hold against that probationer, there's no reason for the probationer to obey the terms of the probation. So what the court said in Littow is that by explicitly extending the term of probation, reviewing courts can infer that the trial court intended and did successfully also extend the period of suspension for the same period of time. So that when the trial judge in this case said your probation is extended for 2 years, she also implicitly suspended. She had to have, because the statute says shall resuspend the remaining sentence, she had to have resuspended what was remaining. But the question is how long that resuspension lasted. And under Virginia case law, it lasted at least as long as that probationary period lasted. I think Littow is a good case on that point. Wright is also a good case on that point as well. Opposing counsel attempts to distinguish Briggs and Wright in his reply brief, and again here in oral argument. Honestly, I think that he's found factual distinctions, but those factual distinctions are distinctions without a difference. The distinctions that he's found did not in any way underlie the reasoning of the courts in Briggs and in Wright. In Wright, the reasoning of the court enunciated was not because, this need for this amendment that came, after the fact. What the court ruled in Wright is by setting a new period of, by resuspending the sentence, it doesn't matter, it's not controlling the fact that the judge didn't explicitly state how long the suspension would last, that the suspended term starts over on the day the sentence is resuspended, that the term is resuspended, and you calculate from that day. So in this case, you would calculate from the day when those 90 days were revoked, the two-year probationary period was imposed, and implicitly another 2 years of a suspended sentence began at that date. So under controlling Virginia case law, that I do not think is distinguishable in any meaningful way. She was still within the trial court's jurisdiction within that 1 year after her probation and suspended sentence had expired when she was given notice, and because her offenses occurred during that 2 year period, she was properly found in violation of her probation. For those reasons, this court should affirm. Unless there are any further questions from the court, yes, Your Honor.
You did not comment on opposing counsel's response to Judge Petty's question that we have different case numbers, different convictions, different awards of court costs, and therefore don't have a law of the case. I don't want to assume the silence means agreement, so I want to ask, do you agree there's no law of the case problem?
It's a good question, and it's not one that I prepared to respond to, not the one that I anticipated. And I will, just kind of off the top of my head, I guess, which is always dangerous, I think there is a distinction between collateral estoppel and law of the case. As I understand the principle of law of the case, when a court enters some judgment or some order, and that judgment or order is not appealed from, it then becomes the law of the case in future litigation. And in this particular case, opposing counsel has appealed from that decision by this court, the Supreme Court. So I don't think it's become the law of the case yet because it's still pending on appeal. The question.
But we're a different case anyway.
And we're a different case anyway. The question of collateral estoppel, I honestly can't answer. Give you an educated guess.
Final judgment.
Then I'll take your honor's word for that.
These are different court costs too.
They are. They're different court costs, different calculations.
We don't even know in the other case whether we're just reading the order. We don't know whether court costs were even involved, whether they had been waived, suspended, whatever.
Correct, Your Honor. Correct, Your Honor. So I do think the issues are squarely before the court, and I would ask the court to affirm. Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honor, briefly just to answer, I think, Judge Petty, your question was about a case where there was a difference between the time the final order and sentencing occurred and how that person was found in violation. And I think that goes to they're on good behavior from the moment that it's announced from the court. And what we have to go back to when we're dealing with someone who's on probation is there are separate and distinct issues that occur. There's a period of good behavior. There's a period of probation, active probation. There's a period of suspended sentence, or there can be a suspended imposition of sentence. All four of those things are distinct, separate concepts. And what we have with the problem here is the judge announces from the bench, you're on probation for 2 years, and then waits 17 days to sign that order. I would say that if what the court is saying is we speak through written orders and trying to say that February 13th is the controlling date, that does mean that for that 17-day period, she's only covered by good behavior. She's not covered by active probation. And that presents a serious problem. And I think the court here should be considering addressing that issue to the trial courts to say, when you announce a sentence, a probationer needs to know exactly how long they're on probation for,
and
what they're...
That's what that case stands for, because it drew the distinction between the imposition of sentence and the recordation of sentence. And even though we say that the trial court speaks through its orders, we say that for purposes of determining what happens when there's some type of variance between the pronouncement and the recordation. Where there is no variance, we look back to the date of pronouncement, not the recording.
And I understand that, but I think what we need to be doing is, for the person who sits at the table and sees a judge, and the judge is telling them what their sentence is, to really be telling them, you're actually on probation for 2 years and 17 days, even though the judge only says 2 years, is what the problem is. And
well,
what
that's why we have defense attorneys to explain that.
I understand that, Your Honor. And but finally, one last point, Your Honor. The fact of whether or not she was given proper notice for these charges doesn't take away from the fact that the first final order can't simply be negated. And if what the Commonwealth is saying is true, that she meant to extend the period of the suspended sentence for that 2 years along with the new act of probation, that would have erased the final order. And we can see in other cases, if there was, for example, sex offender treatment that was initially ordered, and then this occurred, that would erase that condition unless the court specifically addressed it. What I'm trying to say is the court can't do that. If the court ordered sex offender treatment and then extended probation, it should remain the whole way. So I would ask that this be reversed and dismissed, Your Honors. Thank you.
We'll come down and recap.